Blog Talk Radio.
We're going to hear from...
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome. This is the Dr. Jones Show. I am Cool Mike and for Dr. Jones on vacation. As always, I want to, first of all, jump right in and apologize for yesterday. I'm unsure what happened as far as the show getting disconnected. I tried to dial back in, just couldn't do it, and became really frustrating for me. So I actually kind of just gave up. It's a very special show tonight. Welcome, everybody, for coming here. The title of the show today is Black-Owned. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton have for 30 years now been looked at as the gods of the black communities. Maxine Waters, in her 18th year in the Congress, is the goddess of black America. As these so-called black leaders emerge as big-time multimillionaires in America, the clueless blacks continue in record numbers to worship and idolize them, along with President Barack Obama and the new Black Panther movement, looking for them to lead them to a trip to the black promised land. It appears for those leaders they have found the land of opportunity in fine style and grace, and what a shock, their homes are nowhere near the so-called black impoverished communities of America. The message has been the same for decades. The federal government will save blacks. So will the state and local, with every social program known to the world for the last three decades, that's 30 years. Welfare has changed its name, but it has not changed its goals, and neither have the so-called black leaders. They have gotten insanely rich while their message of hate white America, blame white America, is preached almost every second of every day on whatever media outlets will give these people time. But what are they forgetting to tell us? As of April 2011, there are a record number of black billionaires emerged worldwide, a record number, which they seem to forget about talking about. Even here in America, 2011, a record number of black millionaires, from athletes and business and all kinds, especially those politicians who are getting really rich. Those who forget history are destined to repeat it. And those who never learned it, well, nothing will ever change for them. So today's show brings to the table black leaders and the role models. I hope to have some people from BTR to join the show. And this is kind of a little bit tradition. Maybe these are the people that the black community should be following. The people out there that are done finger-pointing and who are not blaming. In tonight's program, we're going to question some answers and answer some questions on tonight's program titled Black-Owned. We're going to jump into a piece, and we'll be right back.
They accuse me of manipulating media, and then once the media calls something, they say I came in and took advantage of the media. The fact is, the media wouldn't have been there if we hadn't come, and it would have been one day short. There have been many incidents that happened that did not become nationally or internationally known. The difference was no one did go in and march and protest and dramatize and make it known. Michael Griffin and Yusuf Harkin have been the only people that died. But the question is, how come no one knows about the other death? Because an activist didn't come in and sort of galvanize the public and sort of make the media pay attention. So don't blame me for being effective, because the job of an activist is to put life in a dark situation.
He actually sets down and plans how to use the press. He will think of situations, and we will listen to situations, and sort of like an ambulance chaser, go out with money and pay his way into situations and actually manipulate the press into coming in with a juicy story For 2 years, Perry McKinnon was an insider, but he broke with Sharpton over the sensational case of Tawana Brawley.
I'm not a liar and I'm not crazy.
In 1987, this 16-year-old girl claimed she'd been raped by six whites, one a policeman. But there were inconsistencies, and 7 months later, an official investigation concluded the story was a hoax. Sharpton was Tawana Brawley's chief spokesman.
Sharpton expressed his doubts in conversations with me, based upon facts that we read out together. Facts that was gleaned from the family. Could not have happened.
Mr. McKinnon, let me make my point. Mr. McKinnon, among other things, has split from you and said out loud in an interview televised today on CBS that this is a pack of lies, that you yourself know that you have not got the goods on anybody, and that there are big holes in your allegation that Tawana Brawley has been sexually assaulted.
You're saying he disbelieve it in private, sure, or something? Oh, of course not. Never in public.
On here. That piece stems back, the Reverend Al Sharpton, going back to the Tawana Brawley case for some of those people who are unfamiliar with it. I'm sure they've pretty much picked up on the tape itself. Tawana Brawley accused some white people of raping her. Well, I think they were white police she accused of. Clearly, not true. The media ate it up. Of course, these cops were guilty and blah, 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 blah. The first people on the scene, of course, were Big Al. And basically, for 30 years now, this kind of stuff has been going on. I don't think anyone, you would be a fool if you were to deny that all these wrongdoings have been going on for many years against blacks. However, it goes against you when I think that when you are dealing with individuals who are lying and members of the black community basically will not step up and acknowledge that they're lying and acknowledge any kind of wrongdoing, most of the people think, well, they have it coming to them because of things that happened long before any of us were alive. But I mean, that's really, really the wrong way of approaching it. Annie, I think I see Southern on the line. Welcome.
Yeah, good afternoon. How you doing tonight?
Good, good. Got a nice full chat room. Couple quick questions.
I just came in, so don't hit me with something. I just walked in.
Yeah, no, I was going to ask you, why don't you give a brief little, I was talking about yesterday, or day before yesterday, I was talking about the other shows. Why don't you tell everybody about, kind of do a quick little evaluation of your show on Tuesday, who your guest was, and how you would evaluate it?
Oh, Tuesday was awesome. I think it was one of the best shows I've had, honestly. I've had some good shows, and I was surprised sometimes by the reaction of people where I thought I had a really, really bad one, and it ended up being with high numbers. But yesterday, I think, was absolutely awesome. I had Representative Joe Wilson, you know, Joe, you lie, Wilson on. I love doing that. Anyway, and we had some fantastic callers, and I had a friend of mine who's also a local resident here, and has had some dealings with some of the things that Joe Wilson has been doing in the area. And it became a very, very interested and at times heated exchange. I would say Congressman Wilson held his ground pretty well. So did my friend. And like I said, it was just an awesome, awesome show. This Friday we're going to have the fair tax people on, and that should be a very interesting debate. But I came in here to listen to you talking about the BS that's being thrown over the people's eyes and the wool being pulled over it with the Right Reverend Al Sharpton and the Jesse Jacksons of our world.
Oh, not just that, but Maxine Waters. In the open, basically what I was talking about is that you look at Jesse Jackson, and he started long before my time, so did Al Sharpton and Maxine Waters. And, I mean, their basic messages depend on government. By starting these, they don't really have a message of forward progress. Their message is just hate, keep everybody, beat everybody down without them even knowing it. Because what has happened is that over the last three decades, these individuals went from basically the poverty to being insanely rich. Jesse Jackson's wealth is unbelievably enormous. And
yes,
I think to myself, how does this happen? If he's supposed to be giving so much and doing all this, which includes his son becoming the congressman.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And actually, I'm putting something, how do you spell hypocrisy? I'm trying to, I'm going to just put it to prove the BS. Here is a link I'm putting up in your chat room to the Jesse Jackson book he wrote. And this is the one I mentioned to you the other day when you were on.
Yep.
And it was about, and the movie's, the book is called About the Money. And he actually wrote about how to become a reverend and become a millionaire by the donations and the other BS that they put into churches. The backdoor deals, the tax write-offs, the other little niches that they have found a way to make themselves multimillionaires by walking on the backs of the very people they claim to help. And the book is right now up in your chat room. It's called On the Money. I put the link up there. Just look for Southern Sense to prove the BS. Tap on that link and tell me if that does not get your blood to boil.
I'll tell you, it certainly does for me. And kind of a quick story, Jesse Jackson, they wrote a book on him regarding shakedown. And Jesse Jackson made a huge bulk of his income by trying to shake down companies. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't know that it was an olive oil company, but he was shaking down the Japanese, and basically everybody was afraid of the race card. If they did not pay Jesse Jackson off kind of in mafia style, he was going to basically accused them of being racist and kind of spread the word in the media, and blacks would, you know, they'd just be black labeled. Well, he had attempted to do it with an Italian company. Basically,
sometimes in the 90s, he got himself into some hot water with the mob.
Well, not just that, but when Jesse Jackson and his gang of chocolate thugs were surrounded by guys much bigger and weren't intimidated and would have gladly removed these people from the face of the earth, you know, it makes me wonder if Jesse Jackson entered a butcher shop. Because I don't know who would have been stupid to do that, but the individual made the comment. He said something along the lines of, you really don't want to fuck with me on this, Jackson. I got all kinds of shit I can throw.
Right.
And he basically did a lot of scooping up on Jesse Jackson, his girlfriends, and his kind of lifestyle, and was about to reveal it. Well, nothing was ever said about that, said and done. So, I mean, basically a lot of these places just kind of, you know, they bent to him. But that
exactly.
still doesn't, it still takes away from this point, Annie. And I hope to have ABC joining us shortly, and hopefully Willie Lawson as well. He was kind of caught up into an appointment. But what is their message for progress? Okay,
there is none.
We do this with our children or whomever when we sit down and we kind of help them with our work and we talk about the where is it?
There is
Why
none,
is it,
and that's the
you know,
point
when
of it.
Bill Cosby there, makes the comment, be a responsible male. Be a responsible. What,
and then he got torn
down.
Yeah, he was torn down. There is no message for progress. The only message is, you are the victim, so take the man for every single dollar you can. In other words, stay on welfare, keep on collecting on the dole, never become anything in your life. Oh, but if you become a rap star, don't forget to help donating to the cause here. And that's all they do. You know, you can make yourself an American Idol star, or you can keep yourself on welfare. And I actually, true story, I do have a very sweet friend of mine, and she probably does listen in every now and then. She lives here in South Carolina. She just is coming out of the military. She served a stint. And her mom turns around, and she wanted to go to school. Her mom turns around, and she goes, well, why do you want to move to Charleston to go to school? Why don't you stay here and get yourself on welfare just like your cousins? Why do you have to turn around and keep on working? She looked at her mother and said, Mom, I can't believe you actually told me to not work and stay on welfare. Can you believe that? This is a grown woman with a child, and her mother is telling her, don't work. Do like your cousins do. Stay on the dole. Stay on the government dollar. Stay in the deep rut you are in. Move into a trailer park and stay on welfare. Is that how you teach your children?
That's unconscionable. And the positive thing about that story you just told is that this person probably in the military did learn hard work, commitment, teamwork, a lot of the intangibles you...
No, I think she learned that on her own before she went into the military. And she went into the military to get away from the environment she's in. And she's been through some difficult times, and one of the reasons why she's getting out of the military. And she's still putting herself up by her own bootstraps. And it's amazing because she turns around and she goes, she cannot have a conversation with anyone in her family. And the reason being is because she's a black female conservative. And that's something that they cannot fathom, that someone can actually want to better themselves. Why? And,
no,
also,
and you know, Annie, that that'll lead us into our my next recording. And I know I played played this before. I'm pretty sure you had heard this. Maybe you did not. Did I play for you the recording by Jesse Jackson Jr., the congressman?
I don't call.
But well, good. Hopefully, I haven't. Because you know how sometimes you say you were in the middle of something and you heard this, and then your blood just got to boiling. Well, I hope you got that martini next to you because you may need a couple sips.
It's wine coolers in the summer.
Well, you may need to swallow a few after listening to this douchebag. This answers exactly. Yes. This kind of falls in line with exactly what you said. And I wonder, you know, people like Perry Steele, people like ABC, Dr. Jones, why aren't they the role models other people point to? I mean, people who have, they've suffered no different than anyone. But,
no,
you know, at certain times, your anger from your past and stuff will emerge. But overall, you're looking at good people.
Well, can I tell you a really quick story before you go to the clip? And this is a true story.
Go ahead.
Now,
no,
I grew up, I graduated high school, it was in the 70s, and at that point, women were not encouraged to go into a lot of fields. And I went to my guidance counselor, and of course, that's what you had to do before you graduated high school, you know, get your counseling, right? And I said, I'd tell you something really mind-boggling. He sat me down, he goes, and my true first name is Anne-Marie, he goes, Anne-Marie, this is what I want you to do. I want you to take secretarial courses. And I said, why? Because when you take secretarial courses, you get yourself a job and marry your boss. Can you believe that? And I looked at him. I said, Mr. Hotchkiss, are you serious? He goes, no. Your best way to get out of where you are, because I did not grow up rich or anything like that. You know, people think because you're white, you got money and path to everything. No, I had nowhere. I was going to go nowhere. He goes, marry your boss and get yourself out of where you're living. Excuse me? You know what? It got my blood so angry. 2 years later, I graduated from college. I owned my own business, and I had 13 people working for me. That's how angry he got me.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. Too bad I didn't know you then. I'd have probably tried to move the union in on you.
Oh, no, you. If you saw me back then, my tight little figure, forget it, honey. You weren't going to be leaving my side.
All righty. Well, give a listen. You got that wine cooler handy?
It's a wine spritzer today.
Okay. Well, get it handy. Listen to this. This was a couple months ago. We know the message that Jesse Jackson, and we're going to be playing some more Al Sharpton, et cetera, but give a listen to this. Just 3 months ago, this is Jesse Jackson's son speaking before Congress.
Mr. Speaker, I believe that the answer to long-term unemployment is actually in the Constitution of the United States. Well, let me say that a little differently. It's not in the Constitution of the United States. It should be in the Constitution of the United States, and one of these days we're going to get there. We need to add to the Constitution the right to a family to have a decent home. What would that do for home construction in this nation? What would that do for millions of unemployed people? He says we need to add to the Constitution the right to medical care. How many doctors would such a right create? He says we need to add to the Constitution of the United States the right to a decent education for every American. How many schools would such a right build from Maine to California? How many people would be put to work building roofs and designing classrooms and providing every student with an iPod and a laptop? How many ghettos and barrios will actually be touched by such an amendment? In fact, very little that we pass in the Congress of the United States even touches the long-term unemployed. Only thing that touches them that this Congress has access to that can actually change their station in life is the Constitution of the United States. Mr. Speaker, there's an even greater America that's in front of us. It's the America that adds to our founding document these basic rights.
Well, Annie, there you go.
Yeah, actually, honestly, I did hear that. I think it was on Andrew Wilkow. But yes, I did hear that when it came out, and I went, to be polite, I'm going to use the initials, WTF. And I think everyone knows what WTF stands for. It just, the right to a house. What, the next thing, you're going to have a right to a pair of shoes, the right to pink underwear. Where does your labeling of rights go? And you're going to add this to the Constitution? Oh, excuse me, the Constitution says now we must all wear green bow ties on Thursdays. Just how ridiculous do they want to get? How much do they want to turn around and control our lives by saying, you must, and you must, you must?
Well, I think they want to control it a lot. I love how he threw in iPods,
mm-hmm.
okay, on top of the laptops. iPod?
As if George Washington ever would have known what the heck an iPod was. They wanted everyone to have an iPod. Why didn't the Constitution state everyone must have a quill and ink and paper? Use that logic.
Right.
If that's what the Constitution and our founding fathers wanted, why didn't they mandate that everyone had the ability to read and write? That's not in the Constitution. But the federal government mandates an education for every single person on the taxpayer's dollar. Instead of having the parents teaching the children, but now we have to have this formalized education that's a burden on every single taxpayer. What? That wasn't what the founding fathers were based about. It was by pulling up your own bootstraps. Homeschooling, I think, is one of the most fantastic things that we've ever developed. But then again, homeschooling is what we all grew up on, as the founding fathers did.
Yeah, well, I think that what happens is in public education overall is a big success. The problem is the politics in it. And when you go into major inner city schools, you're overwhelmed with more bureaucracy and bullshit than you really are of accomplishing the education. Let's face it. I mean, in high school, you're not going to most people aren't going to leave high school just super, super duper, super smart. You're going to learn an awful lot more of the real world along with post high school. But in high school, you really get the roots of what is going to be your tree. You know, that is obviously planted in preschool. But, I mean, is high school is really when you start shaping to be a young man or a young lady. And go ahead.
I don't know particularly if it's high school. I actually found, looking at myself and at people I know, I think it's more the formative years that you actually end up with getting the basis of who you are, not in high school when you're like, I'm thinking about 9, 10, 12. I don't know what high school is today. Is it 9, 10, 12 now?
Yeah.
But I thought junior high was actually the area where I actually became who I was, and I watched a lot of people around me, and I watch kids today, and that's where they actually become who they are. In high school, it's like you're kind of like fine-honing it, so that by the time you get to college, now it's a matter of whether or not you get a professor that's going to brainwash you to push you over to one side or to make you more determined to stay on the other side. I think it's the junior high intermediary school, I'm finding it to be maybe one of the more important areas, and people concentrate on high school. By the time you hit high school, you either know how to read or not. You either know how to do mathematics or not. And now you're here at this age, and now you're playing catch-up. You don't see people really growing as much as when you see them in intermediary and junior high. I think that's where you have to really, really capture the kids and capture the imagination and make them understand what it is to be part, an integral part of a society, and whether or not you want to become part of the problem or part of the solution. And that's where I see it, honestly.
Yeah, well, I can't disagree. I do think If you have these leaders in the black community that are telling people, finish school, learn how to read and write, get your education, I don't think there's any doubt the horrible treatment that blacks have overcome. But I also think we're dealing in a day and age where most of these people only know of these atrocities from people from long ago. Each generation tends to forget more and more, and they need to be reminded. But on that same note, is that I don't think they really care. They're more concerned about bettering themselves as people. But that needs to be the message from these guys. I find it amazing. While they still continue in the black community to bitch and complain about this and that, the people who are telling them to be pissed off are also telling them to be dependent on government and to basically hate white people. And, I mean, instead of pointing out the good black role models, not only here on BTR, but there are many of them out there that lead by example. They're good people. Go ahead. You wanted to say something?
No, I can completely agree with you, and I can probably, off the top of my head, name off dozens of people. It doesn't matter what race, background, or whatever they are, that have done exactly what I have done and probably what you have done, what others have done. Like, for one example, Lenny McAllister, who was a black conservative, the hip-hop Republican, he's now in Chicago, up by your bootstraps. And you can go through a tremendously hard time in your life. And I remember, here I am, a small business owner. I'm about maybe 20 years old at the time, pushed myself through college, got myself a business. I'm not earning a big paycheck, but I've got now 13 people. I have to make sure I can keep this business going so they have their checks. So I'm foregoing a lot of times. I am now newly married, and at that point I was married to a Marine. And he turns around to me one day, and we are actually having a living at just about or below the poverty level. He goes, you know, we can get food stamps if you want. I swear, if I was a violent person, I probably would have decked him at that moment. And I said, don't you ever, ever say that to me again. He goes, why? I says, no one gives me a handout. I'm going to earn every single thing I get. If we have to cut back here and there or whatever, we'll do it. But I am not taking food stamps. I will not debase myself in that manner. And he looked at me like, you serious? I says, no, I'm not going to do it. And we actually struggled for 2 years. 8 years later, I'm divorcing him because he was a lazy SOB in the end, which probably that moment he said food stamps should have put a little light bulb in my head going, boom, 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 loser here. But, you know, that's my attitude, and it's an attitude I find in a lot of people, but whether or not they're encouraged to nurture that attitude, that's what society is really a big problem with. You know, their society, you look at the newspaper, you look at TV, you look at radio, listen to other people, and it's like, give me, give me, give me. Where is it where you turned around and said, I earned this on my own, and no one had anything to do with it. I get 100% kudos on the back. Pat me on the back. I deserve it. Where's that?
Well, one of the reasons you don't see a lot of that is for so many years, if you were to film Maxine Waters the day she got sworn in, the Honorable Congresswoman, if you were to film Al Sharpton 25 years ago, Jesse Jackson 25 years ago, and film them now, their message is 100% the same. And you don't hear them telling people in the black community, be more responsible in what you are doing. It's the white person who supposedly beats them down. That may have been a very valid excuse many, many years ago before any of us were around. You're going back to slave times. But,
yeah.
Education has been this is how these people play their game, and they do it very well. And
I would call them the pariah in society. And we have them, whether or not they're black, white, orange, purple, we have them in every area of society. Look at people such as Joey Behar. And here she is. She plays the whole big thing. Oh, we have been so wrong. And all of a sudden, we have to kowtow to people that don't want to take responsibility for their own lives. Where is it? Is everything still the Twinkie defense? And that's what I call it. It's a Twinkie defense, no matter what you do. No, I turn around and you have, and this is one of the things that we had the debate with your friend at Bengay. I said, you have a personal choice. You have a choice to decide whether or not you behave in a certain manner. And if you do behave in a certain manner, then it's you are going to have to face the actual repercussions and responsibilities of making that choice. So if you decide and behave in a certain manner, you are now going to face certain possibility of contacting certain diseases. You have the responsibility of whether or not your partner is going to turn around and sue you for whatever this or that. It's your personal choice. If you decide to turn left instead of right, it's, again, your personal choice. Answer up to it. Face it like a man, like an adult. But don't turn around and say, the Twinkie defense, because I'm gay, I have to go this way. No. You make a personal choice in your relationships. How you behave and how you act is your personal choice.
Well, and I agree. And another this is something that I really like to I think this drives home points. We can all have a difference of opinion on what Annie says, what Cool Mike says, what Perry Steele or Dr. Jones or Freedomizer Radio may say, or Tesla. Here's one thing you can't. We all look to see, we want to hear a Muslim condemn killing, condemn the suicide bombers. We want to hear them say that this is wrong, that these people don't represent Muslims, these people are crazy, etc. We also look for that in the black community when a crime is being committed. Just prior to the show, I played Reverend Al Sharpton during the Tawana Brawley incident, where even after it was absolutely proven, there's no possible way what she said was accurate. They refused to even acknowledge that. She even left the state because they were basically moving to prosecute her.
Exactly. And it cost the life. It cost the life of one of the assistant DAs that she then accused also of being part of the cover-up and rape. And this poor man, a family man, ended up committing suicide because of the social pressure on him. Now, there may have been other things that may have encouraged it, but the end result was Tawana Brawley caused this man, the Reverend Al Sharpton, Tawana Brawley, and the entire ilk that were pressuring this man, that were out in front of his house protesting, calling him all different names, calling him a Nazi, calling him everything else. This poor man took his life because of them. And I don't understand why New York State did not prosecute them for manslaughter because of his death.
Well, were you a officer then in New York?
Yes.
You know, something had to be wrong with this guy in the first place, Annie. I mean, I agree with you. I think those protests were wrong, but you cannot hold Al Sharpton responsible for a guy who takes his own life. I mean, I don't know.
Well, if you understood the media attacks back then, and I mean, they were vicious. It wasn't every day. It was every frigging 5 to 15 minutes. It was on the news nonstop, and it was completely blanketed. And I mean, when they were out in front of his house, I mean, it was as if the mob that was inside Wisconsin's Capitol was now camped on your doorstep. That's how bad it was. And this poor man trying to protect his family and going through this, and I'm sure somewhere along the way, his wife was probably questioning him, his friends were probably questioning him, and I'm sure they were all turning their back on him. And this went on for months on end, not days, but months. So, yes, I can understand where that pressure can get so much and so bad. And only after he killed himself was he exonerated. Afterwards. So you can imagine what he was facing at that point, where he was being told he was going to be brought before a grand jury, he was going to be prosecuted, and so on and so forth. And what's this man going to think? Here he was, giving his life as an assistant district attorney, now losing his job, losing his family, losing everything, and being told he's going to be arrested. And these people are out there calling you names on your front step. Yes, I can see where it's pushing someone. And I still think to this day they should have been charged with manslaughter for causing his death.
Mm-hmm. Here's something, let's bring Al Sharpton again to the forefront, Big Al. as we all know, sadly, the same type of situation happened, I don't know how many years ago, but it was in
North Carolina.
I think it was in North Carolina with Duke.
Oh, yeah,
and
Duke University.
And Al Sharpton, of course. You know, this is what they feed off of. This is the great, these type of situations, this is the 9/11 for these people. This
yes.
is what, this is the big stage for them because the cameras are all on them. And I've never, ever cared once for Whoopi Goldberg whatsoever. But, however, we're going to play it. We're going to jump into a piece. Take care of that spritzer of yours. Listen to this, and then we'll come back on. And hopefully by that time, our friend Bob from the USMC will be calling in.
I also have a funny story to tell you about Al Sharpton when you get your job.
Okay, well, give a listen. All right.
There's this whole thing. I don't know if y'all know that Isaiah Thompson, got convicted of sexual harassment. And now there's a call by Al Sharpton for people to boycott until Isaiah apologized. Now, he's got till Friday to apologize. But one of the things, you know,
Sharpton said you have until Friday to apologize.
Boycott,
okay.
And stuff. And it really bothered me. You know, I like Al Sharpton. I don't know him that well. We've not, like, hung out and had dinner like him and some other people.
I worked out with him at the gym, actually. When I was covering the Democratic convention, I had to interview him, and he was chunky in those days. And I said to him, Al, I said, listen, you know, what is it with you? You're always marching, and you never lose a pound. So he said to me, that's because I eat after the march. So I've always bonded with him on that level.
Will you do me a favor? Will you ask him to please apologize to the Duke lacrosse players? Because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't speaking out of turn. I wanted to make sure that I was correct. And I know, Al, that you were down there and you were really trying to look out for the folks that you thought were being really run over. But as it turns out, it wasn't true. And I want you to apologize to them because those kids went through hell, and I think we owe it to them.
Kudos for Whoopi.
Yeah, actually, it was a little hard to hear on my end, but it sounds like, I mean, like you said, I'm not a big fan of hers. I mean, I liked her as an actress until she started opening up her mouth. And then, like most people in Hollywood, that's when you turn around and lose me as a fan. But when she does something like that, then I really have to take hats off and congratulations to her. And in that case, yes, she was... I would say, okay, go ahead. Why isn't mainstream media plastering that across the airwaves?
Well, that was on The View, and how do I put that? I don't know the other lady who's a black lady on that show. However, she did not really
Star
back
Jones?
Up Whoopi. Yeah,
is that Star Jones?
She did not basically back up Whoopi on that. Because basically, once again, whether it's Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, Maxine Waters, the Black Panther movement, or in general, the dependent government part of the black community, again, it's, well, that's kind of too bad. They have it coming for what they've done to us, when I really wonder who us is. And the bottom line
is... Yes, versus that, I never understand the us versus them. Aren't we all Americans? Aren't we supposed to be all equal? Isn't this what everyone has fought for through the civil rights? Isn't this where Martin Luther King said, not by the color of the skin, by content of the character? But now it's still the us versus them?
Well, yeah, because if it becomes anything but Annie.
Oh, where'd you go? What happened, Mike? All of a sudden you went dead. Hello? Okay, I'm not hearing anything here.
There, I'm here, Annie. Sorry, I had to, my friend had called me and I hit the wrong button.
I have a little sign in the middle of my computer, and it says, "Is your effing mic on?"
No, what I did is I was doing something with my phone when he called, and I hit answer. So that was me bad. And, there's still a. I find it amazing that I have friends out there who know about the show who have no clue that I'm in the middle of the show. It's almost. I'm not sure that I can put that into actual words. However, the next piece, we are going. We're going to make a comment. You know, I thought I had this. And maybe I don't.
Right. Oh, well, I'll tell you what. While you look for that, let me tell you a story I had. And as you
free.
Know, and, a lot of your listeners, I'm not sure if they do know or not, but I'm a retired New York City police officer out of Brooklyn, New York. Brooklina. And Reverend Al was quite active in the area of I was working in Brooklyn, which Bushwick, Williamsburg, and Crown Heights area. And there was a Muslim march, and they were doing anti-drug market. And Reverend Al decided he was going to get his big, at that time, he was probably about 300, 400 pounds at the time. He wanted to get his big butt in the middle of the whole thing to get publicity. Well, the Muslims had this little bit of a high-riser podium type of thing. You know, like the bleachers, like you see in football games in high schools and stuff. It was a little rinky-dink thing. So the right Reverend Al, his crew, turn around, they climb up all the way up on the top of this high riser, and now we're doing security around the back end just to make sure no gangs want to come in and beat them up or whatever, like anyone's going to mess with right Reverend Al and his security guards. Well, he gets up there. Well, the bleachers weren't balanced enough to hold his weight and the weight of his entourage. And all of a sudden, he's standing on the top of it, and you see his arms like this big bird start to spin in the air, and looks like he was trying to flap his wings to take off, and they're going, and they're going, and they're going. The whole thing goes flying backwards. I swear, the man bounced when he hit the ground. True story, he actually bounced when he hit the ground. Fortunately, thank God, fortunately, no one was hurt, but we're all rushing over, helping people, you know, get up off the ground. No one was hurt. But to see this man with his arms flapping in the air and then bouncing off the ground, I think he went to
stare.
You know, just not to stand there laughing. Anyway.
You actually saw that, huh?
Yes, I was right there.
Oh, boy. How far does Big Al live from, like, what would be your beat? What would have been your beat?
Well, I was in the Bushwick, Williamsburg area, and he frequented just over the precinct line, which was, at that point, was Flatbush Avenue. So if you went over on the other side, probably a matter of a couple of blocks, one of the women I worked with, a police officer in the precinct, she's now living down in Williamsburg area in Virginia somewhere, I think. I'm not sure. But she used to go to the same hairdresser as he. And she would get off of her shift, and he would be sitting there having his hair curled, crimped, whatever the heck they did to it. And she would be amazed at how much time and money he spent on his hair. I think he actually outspent John Edwards. If you took it dollar for dollar, probably outspent John Edwards on his hair.
Is that when he kind of had the, when he was heavy and he had it styling?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, you know, I rarely, I mean, seeing him now, you hardly recognize him because he has lost so much weight.
Man, he is one-fourth of the man. And I'm telling you, some of the protests he did ended up inside our holding cells in the precinct. And, you know, I'll tell you what, cops would line up, actually line up to go into the holding cells. And I'm telling you, this is not a place you want to go walking into because it stank. It actually stank. But they would line up to get pictures standing next to him while he's behind bars. They'd pose next to him. True story.
To Big Al?
Yeah, to Big Al. Yep.
Wow.
They did that with security guards for Eddie Murphy when he did the movie Come to America, which was filmed inside the priest I worked in.
Yeah.
And it was just off of one of the footpaths they used to walk. And security guard to a fight because someone tried to catch the opening, or whatever they call it, when they had that white carpet and they had the first premiere, or the premiere of the movie Coming to America. They actually premiered inside our precinct on Broadway. We have a street called Broadway inside Brooklyn there, yes. And we got into a fight with a couple of fans, and he ended up behind bars, and again, they were lining up just to have a picture with me.
Wow. Oh, so were you there, Annie, were you a police officer in New York when something happened with the Jewish community where they started rioting and they were saying, this is our Rodney King, this is our Rodney King?
Yes. Rodney, well, let me think. We
no,
had,
no, no.
We had,
an
we
incident
had a,
happened with the Jewish people where they were claiming this is our version of the Rodney King.
Yeah, that was in Crown Heights, Eastern Parkway.
Right.
Heights, where a Jewish guy had accidentally hit a kid, and it turned out to be a young black kid. I think he was about, I don't know, 8, 9 years old. He was on a bicycle. And the poor guy, oh, man, what he went through. But they started a pummel him, and then, of course, the Hasidic Jews come in and pull him out and save him. But, yeah, and they tried to – they actually took him to trial on that. He was eventually found innocent. But the devastation he went through, and he did everything to bend over backwards for the family of the kid he hit and accidentally killed. But, oh, man, the massive riots. And, yes, they would actually bus us over there to handle the crowd control and everything. And, in fact, if I remember correctly, there is footage of actually me and two other female police officers. Everyone else is in riot helmets, but we're seen walking across Eastern Parkway. And here's three white female cops. Not one of us is wearing a riot helmet because we hadn't been issued them at the time. But they see it on all mainstream media. It was like CNBC and everything else. And it showed pictures of the riots. They showed the clip of the three of us walking across Eastern Parkway. So, yeah.
So all three of you are together?
Yeah, the three of us, yeah. It was like eeny, meeny, miny, moe, you know, in a row as we're walking across the street. And I was wearing my hat. The girl behind me was not.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, I was. Okay. I went through all those riots and everything, yes. And yeah, and I was working the day that the Twin Towers were hit the first time in 93, and my sister-in-law was inside the Twin Towers at the time, yes.
Wow, that's something. Anyway, we're going to jump into another piece. I want to follow up on that. That's really got to be something. Here's Alan Keyes speaking on racism. And, of course, as we know, Alan Keyes is an Uncle Tom. He's an Oriole. He's like Dr. Jones and Perry Steele and all the other people that how dare they have a different opinion on what's going on. Or a more wiser statement would be, how dare they call it like it is and disagree. But here's Alan Keyes talking about this is a simple problem within the black community, which just continues to be ignored. And this is now one of the reasons why the black community, as far as has slipped back down into a minority, as far as population status behind the Latinos now. So we have a listen.
Important. It's one of the reasons, for instance, I will admit why I think abortion is so important. it has a disproportionate and horrifying impact on the black community. Did you know that something like 13 million black babies have been killed since Roe versus Wade as a result of this holocaust of abortion? Did you know that the black population today is something like 25% less than it would otherwise be because of abortion? Did you know that black women are disproportionately likely to have abortions, that more black babies are being aborted today than are being born? And that as you project these kinds of tendencies into the future, the black population becomes a negligible factor in American politics and other things over the course of the 21st century. I look back on black Americans with a heritage of oppression and slavery that unfortunately is involved in this question as well, because 78% of the abortion clinics that are provided by the most numerous provider of abortions in America, Planned Parenthood, are located in or near the black community. Blacks are 13% of the population. They account for over a third of the abortions. So I think that on these important issues, we have to look for the patterns that still target people on the basis of race, and they're targeting people in the womb.
All righty. Did that come out okay?
Yeah, it came out a lot better than the last clip, definitely. But yes, I completely agree. Being someone, a female, that grew up in the time of Roe v. Wade being debated, this is something that I actually had to wrestle with myself, on top of which being a Roman Catholic, Italian-German Roman Catholic of all things. You can't get any more Roman Catholic than being an Italian Roman Catholic. Unless you're a, you know, Hispanic Roman Catholic, I mean, Jesus, we have it hands down at this point, guilt and all. But yeah, this is something that growing up in the 70s, I had to wrestle with, especially with the women's movement now that had just come out at that point, and it wasn't as liberal as it is now. Yeah, it's something that what Alan Keyes has it completely on point. And as a kid back then, I never thought about the ramifications of what it would mean when they put these Planned Parenthood groups. I mean, here you think as a kid, oh my God, they're going to help the poor and the and everything else. But what parenthood has grown into has been, I won't say it, but genocide. It is government condoned genocide.
Well, another thing too, Anne, is that here we are, 2011, and in so many ways, the black community right now is, I believe, at voting wise, from a political standpoint, I think they're below 15%. So what Alan Keyes was saying 10 years ago, or I don't think it was that long ago, but either way, I mean, it's totally ignored. He's just, he's not one of them. And here's what you have. Exactly what he's saying happening is happening.
Yeah, and they decimated
in many, many ways. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was saying, I'm agreeing with you. They decimated an entire voting segment within a matter of one generation. Think of that one generation. So if I'm thinking about this in the 70s, so by now the children that should have been born would have been their 30s and 40s. I know, I apologize, two generations, within two generations.
Yeah, that's really, really something. Let's jump into another piece and finish up what he was saying. Oh, excuse me, before I paused it. Alan Keyes to me is just, I just really enjoy listening to him because he's realistic and he's still proud of his heritage, which they all should be. But hang on, let's have a listen. Let's see.
I think it's one of the horrifying things about the advocates of abortion that they take the objective condition of poverty and use it to justify a situation in which you then herd and push people toward the killing of their children. If you take those objective circumstances, often contributed to by oppression and discrimination caused by others, and you take that as the excuse for a genocidal attack on a community, I think you are serving one of the worst of evils. But in fact, I don't call people names. I make arguments. And in point of fact, it is the slaveholder's position. The slave owners took the view that black people were not developed enough to be treated as human beings and therefore could be bought and sold like animals. People looking at the babe in the womb take the view that that child is not developed enough to be treated as a human being and therefore can be killed at will. I think that's the same position in principle, and it violates the fundamental principle of our way of life, that we are not developed nor born, but created equal and endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights.
Well, I'm looking
did
for...
Did I just
I'm
not... Looking, I did not... I never heard that. Honestly, I have never heard that piece before, but did I not just say the same thing?
Yeah, exactly. And he had said this, if I'm not mistaken, in his debate. He ran against Barack Obama for U.S. Senate in Illinois. And I'm not exactly sure the year. I think Barack Obama... It would have been like... probably 04 or 06, because Barack Obama did speak at the convention. He did speak at the Democratic convention. I think it was when John Kerry ran against George Bush. That's kind of Barack Obama's introduction to the Democratic world. So I think we actually have John on the line. Area code 215. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm a person that lives in a city where we have a lot of black politicians, and most of them come from the Democratic Party. And there is a lot of corruption in black politics. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton have been, you know, basically men that have benefited from the different conflicts that blacks have had with the police, and in terms of, you know, black people's ability to be able to get hired by, you know, different companies and so forth. And they've basically been able to shake down these companies to the sense that if the company didn't comply with their demands, you know, they would be able to form a protest, and these companies would have to pay in order to keep them at bay or keep them away. And that's how these men have been able to rise in terms of their wealth status. Now, people that have lived in major urban areas that have known about black politicians know that black politicians can be just as corrupt as anyone else. But the loyalty to the Democratic Party is because the Democratic Party has always supported poverty programs that benefited low-income African-Americans, which happened to make up the vast majority of African-Americans in the African-American group of people. Now, you do have very successful African-Americans in the country, and I don't know what all of their viewpoints are on politics. Some of them may be conservative, but if they are conservative and they are Republican, if they're not in the arena of politics, they keep their views to themselves, because by them coming out and saying that, well, this is what you have to do to be successful, and I'm successful, and, you know, these are my values, this would alienate the vast majority of the others in the black community who are not successful. And because they want to build a cohesive movement so that their whole community can rise as one, they don't want these other people who are successful to like be a spoiler of what they're attempting to do to get the whole community employed and to get the whole community in a higher state in terms of their economics. And the strategy has been to rely upon the government and the governmental programs to get the vast majority of these unemployed or lower-tiered employed black Americans back into the economy. That was the strategy, and that strategy came through the Democratic Party. And because
ooh,
the Republic...
Go ahead.
Because the initial feeling was that the the lower tier black Americans and the lower income black Americans, it would be easier to get them on governmental payrolls than it would be to get them into the private sector, because the private sector would form barriers to them getting those type of jobs en masse. So they believe that since the Democratic Party supported the formation of larger government, and the Democratic Party supported poverty programs such as grants in terms of to help with heating bills, the Medicaid program, the support of like larger funds to be given to city and state budgets, that this would increase the level of employment in the black community, because it would be easier for blacks to get these state jobs and these city jobs than it would be for them to get private sector jobs. So therefore, all the black politicians would automatically fall behind in support for the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party supported the expansion of government.
All right, sir, I don't know your name. What is it, sir?
Hey, that's John.
John.
Hi, John. John, are you aware why the majority of blacks became Democrats? Not because of the Civil War or anything like that. Are you aware the moment that the blacks have gone into the Democratic Party? Do you know the moment it happened?
I'm
asking you historically. Do you know? It actually goes down to Martin Luther King.
Well, I'm trying to answer your
question, man.
I'm trying to answer you.
Go ahead.
Okay, the moment that they went in was when the Civil Rights movement occurred, and you had a President Johnson to sign the Voting Rights Act and to sign the Civil Rights
Act. All right, John.
Act, and that's when they went in mass into
John, may I correct you? And I don't mean to be rude. Please forgive me for that. But historically, it was the moment when Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested for civil rights disobedience. He was arrested, thrown into jail. Now, at that point, he and his father were registered Republicans. And they went to the Republican Party, and the Republican Party said, listen, we really don't want to do that because we believe in what you're doing, and we think that, you know, you really have to go the whole long way. Well, Daddy King didn't want his son to stay in jail. So he went Robert F. Kennedy, at that time, Attorney General underneath John F. Kennedy, who was president at that time. And he said to Robert F. Kennedy, can you get my son out of jail? Robert F. Kennedy said, yes, but what are you going to give me back in payment? Daddy King, Martin Luther King Sr., and this is in the book Daddy King and Me, written by Murray M. Silver, who was the civil rights attorney for them at the time in Atlanta. And Martin Luther King Sr. said, I will hand you 600,000 votes for you if you get my son out of jail. From that day forward, every single Baptist ministry across the South then endorsed the Democratic Party. The Republican Party, which is the party that put before President Johnson the Civil Rights Bill, and it was the Republican Party that forced him into signing it into law. But the Republican Party believed in the civil rights movement so strongly, they said, listen, if you honestly believe in this, stay in jail, do it, make yourself an example. But Martin Luther King Sr. wanted to save his son from being in jail, handed them 600,000 votes. And in the end, when Martin Luther King Sr. finally passed away, before he passed away, he said it was the worst thing he ever did because he didn't realize he was going to abrogate the rest of his race into what he considered another level of slavery by putting them into the welfare system they would never, ever get out, because the Democrats knew once they had you by the hook, they got you. Once they put you into that system of needing the government to support you, you'd never walk away from it.
Well, in all fairness, ma'am, that's the first time I've heard, you know, like that particular reason. Now, I mean, I happen to know blacks in this particular city that I live in who hold like different types of positions, like in terms of state rep and so forth. And I know a lot of blacks who are from the Atlanta area who are involved in politics. And
all
the
right.
consensus
Hang on, Jenny.
Go ahead, John. The consensus among a lot of these blacks who are in politics was that the reason why blacks went en masse to the Democrats was because of the advocacy of President Johnson during the Civil Rights Act. Now, I mean, I'm not denying the story that you gave me from that particular book may or may not be true. The reason why blacks were Republicans before the Civil Rights Movement is because the Republican Party was the party of Abraham Lincoln. And they were in that party as a result of their loyalty to Abraham Lincoln after the emancipation. So, you know, the Civil Rights Act was passed, that's when they went into the Democratic Party. And their rationale for staying in the Democratic Party was because of this sense that they wanted to see full employment for their people, and they did not think that they would be able to get that by having blacks en masse apply to these big corporations, because they felt that because of the barriers, the institutional barriers that have been in the country, that it would be more difficult for blacks to get hired by those places. So they felt that if there was an expansion of government, that it would be easier for blacks to get governmental jobs. If you notice that a lot of the institutions in the District of Columbia, such as Howard University, some of the other state colleges that were developed in the Maryland area, this was all developed with money from the federal government. In fact, at one time, Howard University, which was one of the main universities that trained a lot of the black doctors that were in the populace in this country, at one time, their budget was up to 75% funded by the federal government.
All right, can I ask you a question? If you send me a message, send me a little email message with your email, just you and me together, I will exchange with you some not only sites but locations to certain books and historicals, not just someone giving their opinion, but factual documents that will help you help me back the claim. But I don't know if you are aware that underneath President Kennedy, it was the Republican Congress that put before him the Civil Rights Act, and it was under Kennedy that was pushed out of the way. Once Johnson became president, it was the Republican Congress that forced it upon him to sign. He then, after he signed it, wrongly took credit for it, and then he turned around and propagated that myth by telling you that big corporations don't want to hire you. Meanwhile, most corporations were looking for exactly laborers as yourself and everyone else, like low earners like myself, my family, that would have loved us because here we are willing to work for low wage because we were manual laborers. It didn't matter who you were. All they wanted was the job to get done. They're capitalists. They don't care who they hire. You may have a small town coffee shop that didn't want you to walk in there, fine. But when big business is looking for the bottom line, they don't care who they hired and who was standing next to you on line.
Well, actually, ma'am, historically, if we go down, through the record in terms of the institutions that kept blacks out for long periods of time, historically, that's not true. Historically, the barriers for blacks to enter private sector companies, the barriers were very real, and they were there.
Even today,
in states in the Northeast, where you have a heavy concentration of construction companies and labor unions, even today, it is difficult for a lot of blacks to get hired into construction companies, doing construction to get accepted by some of the unions that may
but not,
have
you're talking
a,
unions. Unions are another
right.
story.
Well,
unions
right, but,
are another
but,
story.
Right, but the fact of the matter is that the unions are an essential barrier in order for someone to get employment in certain industries. So, therefore, the private sector barrier was a real barrier. There was there was also a real barrier in terms of blacks that were ready to enter any type of job in which they would be working in an office or any type of professional setting in order for them to get the training if they were applying to go to the state university so that they could get a degree, so that they could get a better paying job. There were barriers in terms of their ability to even get in, to even get into the state universities, which receive most of their funding from the federal government.
So, John, you're talking exactly to what I was speaking about earlier, where I had barriers put in front of me because I'm a female. And I was told I couldn't do certain things because what? Because I'm a woman? And so, yes, I understand that, but there are ways to overcome it. But you may be speaking about something that may have happened 100 years ago, but what we do now today is another story and how we bring ourselves forward. Stop talking about what happened then.
No,
Just for a second. Yeah. My point being is that having grown up through that, through the race riots and through all that, and by having to pull myself up and fight and claw and grab the whole long way, yes, I've been there, I've done that. It doesn't matter what color or gender you are, if you know what it is. Today I'm saying, let's forget about that. Let's look at where we're standing today. What can we do today? What can we do today for our youth to succeed? We already know what we went through. We already know what the problems are. We can see what the barriers were. We're tearing them down. Let's show our kids today, instead of going into the cycle of poverty, tell them and show them how they can become successful without leaning on government for handouts.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say. And I think that's exactly what Mike is trying to say. What can we do today to break that cycle of poverty and bring a successful society and growing economy to ourselves today?
Right. Well, I agree.
No, go ahead, John.
Yeah, I definitely agree with, you know, we have to develop another strategy. But what I'm saying is what the strategy was in the past was the black politicians and the black power brokers felt that the safest strategy to use over this past 40-year period since the assassination of Dr. King was that we use the federal government and we support the Democratic Party because if the government is expanded, it's easier to get our people on a governmental payroll than it is to get them on a private corporation payroll. Because the private corporation, through human resources, I don't know whether you know anybody who works in human resources, but human resources is the main barrier in terms of a lot of people getting employed at a private company. And a lot of excuses can be made in the human resources office. And what they found is that black people had the greatest difficulty moving through those steps, those stages, and less of their people were able to get through the door. So they said, look, we need to tell our people that we want you to vote en masse for the Democrats because we feel that it will bring up our people economically as a whole. More of our people will be doing better economically if we vote for the Democrats. And that's why you've seen solid Democratic support since the assassination of Martin Luther King.
All right, John, what if I were to tell you not only once but several times I was denied jobs and promotions because I was white?
Well,
a proven fact. I was told I could not be hired because even though I was female, I was not Hispanic or black. I've been told that on four separate job interviews. Now, is that right?
what has happened?
May I finish?
John? Annie, your mic is breaking up.
Okay. All right, John, let me put it this way. I was also denied promotion, even though I took a test and passed with a 90% or above. I was told I could not get the promotion to sergeant in the police department because I was white. They had to promote someone that was Hispanic or black above me. Why? Why? When I was competent, why couldn't they hire someone based upon competency? But no, they had to do it by skin color. Is that right? Is that what the United States is all about? Is that what our forefathers fought for? Is that what Martin Luther King wanted? Is this what you want to see in society?
Well, ma'am, you know, this is like a secondary argument in terms of affirmative
is
action.
It? That was my life. That was my way of making a living, and you're telling me that's secondary when you're telling me the very same thing for the people that you knew?
Well,
is that,
ma'am, what I'm saying to you is this, is that the basically through the EEOC, there were programs developed in which if you had a federal job or any type of job that had any type of support coming from the federal government, that company or that job had to have a certain percentage of minorities in that particular labor pool.
That's right.
And the affirmative action policies were put into place because of people that were on committees that were responsible for hiring and but the reason why these policies were put into place is because there was a sense that there were certain groups in the society who were not coming to the playing field fully prepared. It's various socioeconomic reasons why these people were not fully prepared.
Went to the same public school. I had the same education they had. I had no better leg up than them. I wasn't giving a privileged life. I had no money. I came from a poor background with both parents working. I had the same exact education. I went to school that was 75%, 25% white. Does that make me any better prepared than the 75% more that graduated with me? No.
The only thing I can say is these EEOC affirmative action policies were developed because they saw from a statistical point of view, looking at large populations of people. Certainly there could have been abuses in like individual cases. But they're looking from a point of view in terms of looking at the numbers. They're looking at large populations of people. They're seeing that there are discrepancies in terms of their levels of preparation when they are in the applicant pool applying for certain positions. So
1920, yes, I can see that. 1986, 1990, I don't see that. That's BS. That's socialism.
Well, ma'am, honestly, the systems are still in place in terms of
right.
The educational systems have not changed over a 35-year period of time. So you have generations of people going through these same systems, coming out with the same level of preparation.
I disagree with that.
And they're coming into these applicant pools, whether they be for the fire department, the police department, or whatever department that is funded by the government, or whether they be going into private corporations
that are partially funded
by the government.
No.
They're entering these different types of jobs.
No.
And they're coming
to. I disagree with that. Because I see the quality of people coming out, and the schools are working twice as hard, especially here in Beaufort County. They are now having programs to help young men that happen to be black that are refusing to graduate because they refuse to attend classes. That's their choice. It's their choice whether or not they want to learn. No, it's not a matter of being underprivileged. It's a matter of feeling that you are so privileged that you can now lean and earn your money off the government with welfare, with SNAP programs, the food programs, with Section 8 so you get free housing, with unemployment and Medicaid and so on and so forth. The next thing you know, they're sitting there on the corner picking up their checks out of the mailbox, going out and buying their six packs and their dope and everything else because they know they can live off the government. Cut that out, make them earn a living, and you're going to find a better educated workforce because all of a sudden they know the handout is not going to be there for many more. Take the handout.
I think you're speaking, man, honestly, I think you're speaking to a certain subpopulace of the black Americans that is not speaking to the vast majority. The vast
it's
majority.
Not just, I'm looking
vast majority
at,
happen to be working class.
Americans do it, and I'm telling you, my parents have a small piece of property. It's not a big one. It only costs them $40,000, but they now rent it out so they can have an income to pay for the mortgage they put on the property. The people living on the property are not even making the payments to cover the mortgage my parents are paying for it. Now, this is my parents, a property they wanted to move into because now they're in their 80s and they wanted to live within a mile of me so that when something happens, they can be, I can be near them and help them get to the hospital, whatever they need to do. These people aren't even making the payments on it, the rent on it, to cover the mortgage. Why? Because these are young white kids, white, and they're on welfare, they're on SNAP, they're on unemployment. They're even going to college. The county and the state and the federal government is paying them money to go to school. So he has an excuse where he doesn't have to work. He's going to school one day a week and not working the rest of the week. And that's his excuse for not finding a job. It is a mentality in today's society, and we've got to break that cycle. And you've got to turn around and say, it's not welfare, it's welfare to work. It's not unemployment, it's unemployment to work. You've got to get them back into the workforce.
Right. Well, I personally agree there has been a personal breakdown in terms of the cultural practices of black Americans. And the culture that they had was a working class culture before the civil rights movement when they were in segregated groups. They had a working class culture. So what has happened since that time is because of this strategy of using the Democratic Party to expand the government, to get them on government payrolls, and their ability to apply for these poverty programs through the federal government, it broke down their culture, their working class culture that they had previous to that time. That has occurred.
That's
an internal problem. That's an internal problem within the community. But there also is a large segment of the black community that is still working class, that still holds down a job, but they
yes.
are not able to advance in that job, but they still consistently work, and their children are trying to better their lives, trying to move up in the system and get a higher-paying job. These are the individuals who are moving through the public educational system, being miseducated or not getting the same level of education as they would if their parents had the money to send them to a private academy. And these are the individuals that are applying for the police department jobs, that are applying for the fire department jobs, and they may have a discrepancy in terms of their level of standard of the education they receive when they are in the applicant pool for these jobs. And
again, I will...
And this is where the EEOC and the affirmative action different programs come into play because they realize that the path that they were on the level at which they were prepared at the time they applied for these positions, they were not as well prepared as someone else who may have come from a slightly different background. because you have to realize property taxes is the instrument that is used to fund the school districts. So if you have someone, say, that comes from a certain area where it's working class white and the majority of the people, you know, pay their taxes and they have slightly better homes than, say, someone that may come from, say, a place like a Queens, New York, where you may have low income mixed with working class, the property taxes in that area are lower than they are for someone coming from a working class type of suburb. So, therefore, their school districts are not receiving the same educational resources as someone coming from an outlying area.
All right,
so
John,
if they're staying in that school district for 12 years, and I personally know people that work in the educational field, and they can attest to this. Any type of standardized testing that is used to measure the education of these individuals that come from these lower income school districts, the standardized testing is directly proportional to the income level of their family. This has been proven in educational journals time and time again, in academic educational journals.
Explain the problem I have here in Beaufort County then. Beaufort County is one of the highest in tax revenue. Our tax revenues here are so high that when we send money up to the state, to Columbia, they do not return any funds to us because they said we have such a high tax level that our school districts don't need them to return our own tax money back to us. Consequently, we have less than 50% of our people graduating high school. Now, guaranteed in the highest area, the richest area, which is Hilton Head, which is about 20 to 30 miles away from where I am, but they're part of the county I'm in, and because they are so rich, they have a nice, cushy little thing. But the rest of us here in the county have the lowest graduation rate. And why? Because our tax dollars are so high. But it doesn't correlate into a graduation rate. It doesn't correlate into the education. We don't have the jobs here. And if anyone listened to us talking to Bill Wilson on Tuesday on my show, would have heard us bitching at him because he's not bringing jobs in here. We are below minimum wage. We have only servitude jobs here. You can work as a waiter, a waitress, a maid, janitor. The jobs are not here, even though the tax dollars in the school districts are, and supposedly we're supposed to have the environment here to provide those jobs, but it doesn't matter if you're black, white, or Hispanic, it's not here. The graduation rate is not here. The jobs are not here. And it's what government has done to us. And this is why I'm saying we have to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. We have to turn around and stop relying on government to hand us the jobs, hand us everything else on the silver platter. We prove ourselves.
Well, also, ma'am, you know, I don't know whether you interact with social workers, you know, anybody who works in social work or whatever. But if you do, you know, if you get some of the case studies that people have that work in major urban centers like the one I'm in, you know, some of the case studies are horror stories. You say pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Some people don't have boots, man. I mean, you have, you know, you have a lot of people who are in these different areas that are suffering in terms of what they are able to interact with every day and the amount of money that is coming into the household through welfare or whatever is not as great as what you may think. And there are also other factors in terms of abuse and so forth that occurs in households that social workers only know about, but the general public does not know about.
All right, John, you live in New York?
Hold on. I'm gonna I think we got valid points on both ends, obviously. But I'm gonna jump into it. But here's one of the another reason on why this discussion is taking place. This is one of the reasons why progress is hampered so bad in the black communities. And to be perfectly honest, I agree with you, John, in some ways. I think there are corporations that still don't want to hire blacks that have excuse. But I think in many ways the blacks shoot themselves in the foot. I don't think it's right. But anyway, we're going to jump into a piece, and I think this is where today's follow the leader continues to be the wrong leaders. And while they genocide themselves, I mean, just give a listen to this piece. This is the Black Panther Movement regarding the Duke LaCrosse situation.
Let me finish the question. Happened to white people. You want them exterminated or not? What is your view?
I have to say what Malcolm X said. You can't put a man on a stove or an oven and then get mad at what he says. You are, white people always put black people on the hot seat, then get mad at their comments.
You're not going to apologize to the Duke lacrosse team that you smeared, that you convicted. Didn't you hear the North Carolina Attorney General's statement? Didn't you hear that they said that the evidence is that there was no attack? What exactly?
I didn't hear that. I'm a criminal defense attorney. Many clients that I've had, the cases have been dropped against them, but I can't say that nothing went wrong. What I hear is political pressure that a powerful white university with powerful rich white descendants against a poor black woman, the case has been thrown out, but Nifong didn't interview the witness and charge the case properly.
And last May, one of your members said to Reed Seligman, one of the Duke lacrosse players, quote, that he was a dead man walking. You're not going to apologize for that?
First of all, I can't confirm that's true. Will you apologize for being a political prostitute, for Bill O'Reilly, a white male chauvinist, racist, and
you're calling,
color.
You want to call me a whore on national TV?
Yes,
there's only one whore on this split screen, and it's you, Mr. Shabazz.
As a woman of color,
you should be ashamed of yourself
for
profiting off of your racial poison.
Bill O'Reilly. You should be ashamed of yourself for defending and being a spokesman.
You still supporting
O.J.
O.J. Simpson, Mr. Shabazz?
Do you support the acquittal?
Are you?
Do you stand by, or does Bill O'Reilly apologize when a jury?
You want to say some of your anti-Semitic propaganda that you've made your whole career off?
What is your point, man?
What is your point is that you're calling me a political prostitute when that's your whole entire life, and you will not apologize to these young men who have been exonerated. When was the last time you talked to the accuser in this case?
That's between me and that
Did you use the term cracker? Did you use the term Uncle Tom? Did you say you ain't in Israel? Did you say you're going to get your Jewish ass beat? Did you say that? Did you say that, sir?
Let me say this.
Did
Let
you say it, yes or no, sir? Is that you?
No, I'm a talk. On this show.
Did you say it or not say it?
Yes, I did.
Here's what I want to get back to with you, Mr. Nzinga. If you say you ain't in Israel, that's going to be, you're going to get your Jewish ass beat. Why don't you like Jews? Why don't you like Jewish people? Why don't you like Israel? Why would you use...
Oh, okay. My God.
Yeah. My point in playing these type of recordings is this creates racial tensions. And while a huge percentage of the people, John, that I believe that need those type of jobs that we're talking about, not the government jobs, but the manual labor jobs, et cetera, I think when people see this, and they don't see black people condemning this, when a black girl accused white people of rape, it never, ever happened. 100% basically of blacks ran to the aid of her, and yet even after they were exonerated, proven she's a liar, she had 5 different flavors of basic cum in her panties, you still don't see them apologizing for her. They're making excuses. They're saying it's okay, because these people are white, and this is just payback for what happened many years ago. And you need people in the black community to stand up and You know, two wrongs don't make a right. And one of the sad parts, go ahead.
As being a member of the black community, I can tell you that Malik Shabazz is a member of the Nation of Islam and a member of the Black Panther Party. And the Nation of Islam and the Black Panther Party do not represent even the majority of the black community. The Nation of Islam is a cult group that is an offshoot of Orthodox Islam. The new Black Panther Party was a party that was developed in the 90s, which was supposed to be the new generation of the Black Panther Party that existed in the 60s and 70s. But these organizations do not represent the viewpoints of the vast majority of black Americans in this country. So when they get on television and they make outlandish statements and you don't see blacks showing up to condemn them, you know, it's because probably most blacks are not even paying attention to what's going on. But I can tell you, as a member of the black community, the Nation of Islam and the new Black Panther Party do not have huge numbers of blacks on their membership rolls. That is not the case. But the frustration that blacks have had, who were working class people for the most part, and who were trying to better their lives with their children, the frustration that they have had is there have been real documented barriers that they have come up against in their attempt to break down certain institutional doors that have stood in their way in this country. And that has been a fact, and as a result of that, the strategy that the politicians and the power brokers in their community developed was one in which we vote as a voting bloc for a particular party because this party supports governmental expansion, and through governmental expansion, it'd be easier for us to get into the economy because en masse, a lot of us are not going to get into the economy because we may not be the type of person that the company is looking for. And as I stated, human resources is a very subjective office in any corporate structure. The human resources officer has more power probably than the CEO. You know, they can pick and choose who they want. So if someone
not by law.
Laws don't matter though, Annie. John is correct in there. Human resources can do as they want. It's the initial screener who basically is the lackey.
I don't know about that because I've owned and managed several businesses, and having to hire and fire people, you had to jump through hoops. You had to document it, especially. And John, do you live in New York, John?
No. I have to live in the Philadelphia area, but I have to know a lot of people that live in the New York area.
I ask you to be defensive because you only cited a couple of things in New York, which, you know, piqued my curiosity. Having lived in the New York area, having owned a business, having managed them, several businesses in New York, I know what I had to do. I had a document. So if I turned around and I found someone I did not want to hire, I had to document reason why I didn't hire that person. If I had to let someone go, I had to document three separate incidents where I had to sit them down, talk to them, and tell them why that we have a problem with them. You're late. You come in, you're dressed in such a, you're beyond the company standards, you stink or whatever. Whatever the thing is, you had to turn around and document every single thing. You had to dot your I's, cross your T's. So I don't know what type of resource officers you're talking about that violate these rules. If they do violate them, then you have a lawsuit. And that's what legal repercussions are for. But to turn around and just blanketly say resource officers, being in that position, I find that a little hard to swallow.
Hang on, John. Annie, you were your own company, and it was a smaller company.
But I also worked for, I also worked for a mid-sized law firm where I had about the 30-some-odd people I was also taking care of.
That's just not reality, Annie. I mean, the reality is human resources companies have the right to discriminate all the time, and they still do. What the grounds for it doesn't necessarily have to be a black or a white type issue, but that just goes on. The little person has no fight. The government, unless you are in class action, I've numerously witnessed that and heard people talking about that working in the nightclub life. Area code 6716. Are you with us?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You want to go ahead and comment? Welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just listening to the lady talking about her experience as a human resource. I live in New York State. And I would tell you off the bat my experience in the work field here in New York State. First of all, there is racism. And I don't make an excuse about it. I'm not bringing any class action suits about it. But what happens here in New York State is that when you put in the application, you have a lot of black people that are scared to have what they deem as an ethnic name. I mean, you have black people here that will tell you, don't name your child anything that can be identified as black. Because what happens at Human Resources, when they get the applications, they immediately throw them away. And you have a whole slew of black people across the country that don't want people to name their child anything ethnic or a name like Tyrone or anything that can be identified as black.
Wow, that's so
wrong. So here's the issue. Here's my issue. Now, I totally disagree with it, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm like, if you're going to turn me down for a job because I have an ethnic name, then you're actually saving me gas money. That's my personal thing, right? Like, good, trash the application, I keep looking for work. Somebody's going to hire me, right? But the thing that a lot of people don't get about racism is that even if you get, because I have a, let's say, a white-sounding name. Now, and once you call me in with the interview, if you just, called me in and I got past that part, even at the interview, they can obviously see you're black. So if they have no intentions on hiring you, they will find a reason not to hire you. Once again, I understand what the lady is saying, and I do respect what she's saying, working in human resource and the documentation. But let's be honest. A lot of companies in New York State will start hiring, especially if they're doing mass hiring. And if they get too many black people inside their workplace, they come up with new rules. For case in point, I used to work for a company called Client Logic when I first moved to Buffalo. And one of the rules, and that's just call center, it's just customer service, low paying, doing nothing, right, handling Sprint customers, right, a call center now. They had so many black people that all of a sudden they passed a new rule, no Timberlands. Of course, Timberlands is a boot popular with black people, black youth, and one has to ask themselves, right, why make a rule against a brand of shoe?
Heck, I used
those
Timberlands
black,
when I
those
was on
just
patrol.
Black rules. Yeah,
I'm
but those are black rules.
Right now.
Those are black rules, right? Those are black rules because a lot of black kids, a lot of black people, a lot of black males wear Timberlands. So what happened is somebody walked in with Timberlands, and because they committed other violations, there we go. You got on Timberlands, that's another violation, you're out the door. My point is this, is that here in New York State, I don't know about in everybody else's state, is that you have situations where they get too many blacks, come up with the black rules. So you might have been late one day, you might have been late another day, and then you violate one of the black rules. It kind of helps the people in human resources if they're racist, if that's really one of the problems inside that particular company, not all companies, but it helps them go ahead and cross the T's, dot the I's, and get that black face out of there.
Well, sir,
hang on, Annie. In order to have fired a black person, What must you have done first?
Well, you always have to establish something.
There is an answer to that question. In order
to fire
somebody who is black, you must have done what first?
You have to violate something.
No.
Also,
in order to terminate them, you must have hired them in the first place.
Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, and I agree. I mean, I think when they make up stupid rules like that, there's no – you can come up with all kinds of bullshit why those rules are in place, but you know actually the real reason why they're in place. That's just
You
can't even – anyone with common sense can't even debate that. I'm sorry.
But that's the thing in our country.
Everyone's going to get a chance to speak here. John, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I just wanted to add what was being said. In the first 90 days, if you're a new hire, all they need is 3 violations and you're automatically fired. That's at a lot of jobs that you'll find maybe in the Pennsylvania area or, you know, maybe even down there in Tennessee. Is that,
Speak for that a lot of times.
That's all it takes. So if they have rules made up for black people and if you commit one other violation and you're in your first 90 days, then you're automatically fired.
Well, I think the rules apply for everyone. I don't necessarily think for black people. Annie, go ahead and speak.
Area 716,
you will follow her.
It's the other caller, I don't know his name.
William.
William? All right. You said in which area in New York?
In Buffalo.
Okay. My sister is an attorney up in Albany area. I grew up on Long Island. Now,
Buffalo Bills fan on the line? Damn.
I love the Bills. Love to hate them.
I'm a Bears fan. Go ahead, Annie. I'm sorry.
You said they were pitching a bitch because you were wearing Timberlands?
Yeah.
All right. Now,
it's literally, a call center, right?
Yeah. No, hang on.
So you might have 500 employees.
Hang on a second. Now, I was a cop in Brooklyn, New York, and I would tell you 95% of us wore Timberland boots because they were damn good boots. Now, if you turned around and fired someone here, because I live now in South Carolina, if you tried to fire someone wearing Timberland boots, you would have no one to employ because I'm telling you right now, 95% of your employee base would be wearing those boots.
And I understand what you're saying. But see, that's the dynamics of racism right there, which you just explained, right? If I lived and worked in your area, right, where, let's say, the white people and other groups in the norm, they just wear Timberland boots, it would not be an issue. It would be something else. Up here in Buffalo, and this is the only reason why I remember that, right, is because the call center was predominantly black, right?
All right, don't you?
I thought it was odd that they singled out the one thing that black males love to wear to work, Timberland boots.
But aren't
the white?
Hang on, William. Aren't you saying? But people complain about white cops in New York, but 95% of the white cops on patrol in New York are wearing Timberland boots because they're damn good boots.
Where you're down at? Inside the city, because I did live in the city, right? Now I never had a problem with white cops, right?
Okay.
And I'm gonna be honest with you.
Well,
right. If I got pulled over in New York, and I also used to live in Atlanta. Now, I'm a black male, right? And my experiences are unique to me, and as well as I share experience with other blacks, right? Mm-hmm. In New York City, when I'm driving down the street and I get pulled over, I hope the cop is white.
Oh, good.
Why is that?
Because a black cop is worse. I'm in Georgia, and I get pulled over by a cop in Atlanta anyway. I hope the officer is white.
Wait a minute. What do you mean? It's different. I mean, don't they go by the protocol, license, registration? I'm kind of not.
Protocol in the law is whatever they want that protocol to be that day.
Oh, okay.
If they are looking, and I'm not making this stuff up, if they are looking for a black male, 5'10", 250 pounds, in the South, in some parts of the South, I'm not going to say all parts of the South, in my experience in the South, that means they have to pull over every black male from 4'11 to 7'2", anywhere from 100 pounds to 380. You know, mm-hmm. you have a specific description, but we only see one black person. Pull them over, right?
So, does a black cop tend to, like, be more of a bully to a black person?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, I'm
definitely, you'll get your... So. And I'm not kidding. I'm not even exaggerating. When a black cop comes up to your car, you be respectful. You don't say anything. You answer the questions. And even if you do that, he will find a way to get smart. He will find a way to disrespect you. He wants to get a rise out of you.
Uh-huh. Annie, how about you? When you pull people over, don't you just base license, registration, proof of insurance, or whatever the routine is in different states?
Yeah, and you got to understand. Now, I retired back in 1996, so my last days on patrol, actually, before I got hurt, was 1994. But still, I had really something that really floored me. I pulled this guy over, and the back window on his car was knocked out. And one of the common things you have with people trying to steal cars is they'll knock out the back window, reach around, pop the door open, and take the car. And it was, I don't know, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, which is prime time for cars to be stolen. I pulled this guy over, and he was wearing like a raggedy old sweater and shit. And it was a black guy, and he starts, you know, yelling at me, like, why the hell you pull me over? And I get his license and registration, and I walk back, and I find it matches his license. So he starts giving me a rash of shit. And I said, sir, the reason being is you're at X time in the morning, the back window of your car is broken open, and I know there's been a rash of car thefts around the area. He goes, you didn't do that because I was black. And I said, no, sir. Step out of the car and take a look at it, and then look at it from my eyes. And he did. He turns around and goes, you know what, officer? I'm glad you stopped. If it was my car stolen, I'm glad you would have stopped it and found it for me. So, you know, you have to look at it from both sides before you turn around and pitch the bitch.
And yeah, you know what? I actually agree with her.
Smaller city. Hang on a second, William. I'm just from a smaller city, so I don't pertain to knowing everything. So if I don't, that's why I'm asking. That's why I'd ask questions, William. I just don't know. So there's certain things. Everybody can get on here, and just because they're the commentator, they can pretend that they're an Einstein. I'm kind of middle-of-the-road type person. John, did you want to weigh in before we went to William, since I cut you off earlier?
No. I mean, that's fine.
Okay.
You can continue.
Yeah, William, go ahead.
Well, see, this is what I want to say, and this is what I tell everybody. You know, racism is a funny thing. Like, in her situation, right, first of all, that guy had no business. Once you're pulled over by a cop, you're not supposed to be mouthing off at the cop. I don't care who you are, what you're doing, whatever's going on, you know, and this is how I view it. That cop has a gun, a badge, a taser, and a backup button. Why are you mouthing off at the cop?
A backup.
Especially if you know you haven't done anything wrong, right? And I don't care if you black, white, Hispanic, or whatever. Even if you are a criminal, shut up. You know, and that's how I behave when I'm pulled over by cops, right? But it's just been in my experience that, you know, even if I behave correctly, like the way I'm supposed to, I might be irritated. If I'm irritated, it will be visible, right? But I'm not going to mouth off at her because I don't know why she stopped me. She could be trying to save my life. She could be telling me, look, you don't want to go down there. Something's going on, right? Because that's the role of the police officer. But however, I have found that when black police officers, some, pull you over, you get a lot of attitude from them. And I do understand what cops go through. My thing about the police is like, don't make me the criminal you're looking for.
No, that I agree.
Unless I'm the criminal you're looking for.
I think that's good. I think that's a very good explanation in that. By the way, John, so you never knew I was an Arab until you went to my Facebook page? You always thought I was just a white boy?
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't tell by your voice because sometimes people from the Middle East have an accent.
No, my parents are actually in the Middle East.
John, you did not say that. You did not, John.
All right, it's all good. You know what? is part of the best part of life is laughing at yourself. And John is a good guy. He's been a great caller with the Perry Steele Show. And, I mean, Perry schooled me for forever to be able to host my own show. And that's why I say stuff like, I think in the black communities, I think you have people like Perry Steele and many others who are better role models than the pimps, the Jesse Jacksons and the L. Sharptons and the Maxine Waters, who just continue to become millionaires. People like Perry Steele help anyone. They help their neighbors. And, you know, I told him, I said, I really want to do this on my own for a while. And, you know, he almost felt like it was one of his kids ready to kind of march off and graduate school. And, I mean, I think that in many of the areas of the black community, we need to be able to point to the guy across the street as your role model and not really a person who just keeps inciting not only trouble, but a person who says you need to depend more on government. Because one thing we're learning, government is the worst enemy of the people. And the more it just balloons and gets bigger, the more I think these people just become pimps. And I don't think politicians discriminate. I think they're greedy criminals, and they steal from us all. John, I'm going to give you 1 minute to close, and then we're going to go all the way down to Annie and then William. The new caller, you get to close the show. John?
Yeah, well, I think most people would agree that some of the leaders of the black community have, you know, used the black community for their own personal gain. Hopefully, a new type of paradigm for, you know, the black culture can be developed so that they can advance as a people. Because currently, under Obama, they're losing ground. So I think, you know, something has to occur in the next couple of years to get them back on track.
Okay, Annie.
If we turn around and stop looking at each other by race or gender or sexual orientation, if we start looking at each other as equals, isn't this what, you know, Martin Luther King fought for? Isn't this what those of us that grew up in that civil rights era have all stood there and marched for and fought for, no matter whether or not you're a Democrat, Republican, or a purple people eater? Isn't this what we're all looking for? And if we turn around and say, let's take personal responsibility for our actions, what's wrong with that? And I think we have to look back at the basics and start working from them again.
Yeah. William, you want to go ahead? By the way, William, feel free to be a regular caller anytime. You're always more than welcome here. And even when you disagree,
I like this.
We don't mute. You know, we don't mute mics, or as long as there's no you know, swearing and name. Hey, this show's all about the differences of opinion.
Okay.
Well, go ahead. You have 1 minute close.
Well, I like to close and just say what people have to understand is respect. You may not like black people, but you should respect the black person next to you because you don't know what they're capable of. You may not like white people, but you should respect the white people you're dealing with because you don't know what they're capable of. We live in America. People have to stop pretending that black people, especially black people, are half this country. We are only, 12% of this nation?
Yep.
And people don't realize that. You cannot blame the fact that you don't have a job, you don't have this, everything, the economy is bad, just on what black people are doing. There's not enough of us to blame it, right? You need to blame the people that's actually affecting you. It may be government, maybe your own community. But your problem is usually not black people.
Mike, can I just do one thing? Because, you know, listen to this program has actually brought something home that's really, really hard for me. Now, growing up, my parents, like I said, raised us right. And I had an adopted brother. His name is Frank Clay. He recently passed away about a little over a year ago. And we didn't know about it because of various health problems, he went a little off the wall on us. And when we found out he had passed away, and he was young, he's, I would say, about 2 years younger than I am, my brother tried to claim his body. The problem being is we're white, he's black. And we have been fighting now for almost 2 years to claim his body, to bury him. And the big problem is they don't believe us that when we say that, hey, we care about them, we want to give them a decent burial, we don't want them up in Potter's Field, they won't release the body because we're white, he's black. Now, where's the discrimination? This is the reverse discrimination. When we want to take care of someone we love about, we cared about, we grew up with, and he's my brother. I don't care what anyone says. He is my baby brother, and we can't get his body. So if anyone lives out there on Long Island, you turn around to Suffolk County, the congressman there, and say, why don't you release this body, and why don't you let us bring him home where he belongs and let us bury him?
No, that's a sad thing of politics, I'll tell you. And that's, you know, it's a dirty business. That's why I say if we want to change things, these people won't go without a fight. And I want to thank John, I want to thank William, and thank Annie for calling. Tomorrow night I am going to be on also. Tomorrow night's going to be a great topic, guys. Everyone join me. Last week I talked about the five Republicans. I called them the pimps who have been around for basically about like 300 years of politics in the federal government. We're going to do tomorrow, we're going to do five Democrats, I call the Fab Five, that I think for years have just taken advantage as we the people. Two of them were in office so long, Robert Byrd and another one. They died in freaking office. They were around so long, they died in office.
You talk about Strom Thurmond?
They were going to die. They didn't just win. Bunch of, and just show you how stupid we as people are. Knowing these people are going to die, we reelect them. But anyway, tomorrow's going to be a great show. If you guys want to call in, I'm going to be on 11 p.m. Eastern. You guys can have the whole 2 hours. You know, the show's not about me. It's about you. And, John, you give my love to Perry for me, will you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, sorry to disappoint you. I wasn't a white boy, John. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.